Okay, so this evening, Sutta, it's entitled Chana. It's number 90 in the Khandasamyutta. And I'll just give a little background first. This Chana was the Buddha's charioteer. And right off the bat, there's a little bit of a footnote that gives a little background, and then I'll fill in a little more. The commentaries identify this Chana with the Bodhisattva's charioteer who led him out of the palace on the night of his great renunciation. He had received ordination as a monk, but because of his former close relationship with the Buddha, he became proud and domineering and spoke harshly to the other bhikkhus. Shortly before his parinibbana, the Buddha had instructed the Sangha to impose on him the Brahmadanda, which is called the silence treatment. When Chana realized he was being treated as a pariah by the Sangha, he was shaken by a sense of urgency. And that's the place where this sutta starts, after he's been imposed, admonished, and this penalty imposed. But I thought I'd give a little background just to give you a flavor of what he might have been like anyway, because he was the instigator of several of the rules in the Vinaya. Several Pachitya rules and a Sanghadisesa rule as well. So just to give you a little bit of a hint, he was the instigator of Pachitya 12, I believe. Yeah, 12, which is the rule about evasive speech and causing frustration are to be confessed. Pachitya 12. And the brief origin story for this rule is, now at that time, Venerable Chana, having misbehaved and being examined about the offense in the midst of the community, wandered around one thing by way of another. Who has committed the offense? Who was committed? With regard to what matter was it committed? What was committed? How was it committed? What are you saying? Why do you say it? So this is an example of what we call evasive speech. He was also the instigator of another rule, another Pachitya, number 71. At Kosambi in Gosita's monastery. Now at that time the Venerable Chana indulged in bad habits. Monks spoke thus, Reverend Chana, do not do that. It is not allowable. He spoke thus, Your Reverences, I will not train myself in this rule of training until I have inquired about it of another monk, experienced, expert in discipline. The origin stories sometimes are pretty brief, but he was also for number 54, and the origin story wasn't very much other than that kind of similar to the previous one I just read. But that's the rule on disrespect. Disrespect is to be confessed. And then the Sanghadisesa, number 12 rule, is a rule that imposes Sanghadisesa offense on a bhikkhu who is difficult to admonish. The origin story to this particular rule is here again quoting Chana. He's obviously been admonished for a number of these other rules, and they're basically telling him that he's gone so far as to be considered somebody who is so difficult to admonish that he's eligible for banishment. He says, "You think you are to admonish me? It is I who should admonish you. The Buddha is mine. The Dhamma is mine. It was by my young master that the Dhamma was realized. Just as a great wind, when blowing, would gather up grass, sticks, leaves, and rubbish, or a mountain-born river would gather up water, weeds, and scum, so you, in going forth, have been gathered up from various names, various clans, various ancestries, various families. You think you are to admonish me? it is I who should admonish you. So, gives you a little bit of a flavor of of Channa. So he was difficult to admonish. He was basically a pain to live with. But after this, the Buddha imposed this penalty on him of essentially the silent treatment. This was close to the Buddha's passing away, the parinibbana, that happened. So here we are at the beginning of this sutta, when he is feeling remorseful and is shaken by this extreme act that the Buddha imposed on him as he was close to passing away. On one occasion, a number of bhikkhus were dwelling at Varanasi in the deer park at Isipatana. Then in the evening, the Venerable Channa emerged from seclusion and, taking his key, went from dwelling to dwelling, saying to the elder bhikkhus, "Let the elder venerable ones exhort me. Let them instruct me. Let them give me a Dhamma talk in such a way that I might see the Dhamma." When this was said, the elder bhikkhu said to the Venerable Channa, "Form, friend Channa, is impermanent. Feeling is impermanent. Perception is impermanent. Volitional formations are impermanent. Consciousness is impermanent. Form is not self. Feeling is not self. Perception is not self. Volitional formations are not self. Consciousness is not self. All formations are impermanent. All phenomena are not self." Then it occurred to the Venerable Channa, "I too think in this way. Form is impermanent, etc. Consciousness is impermanent. Form is not self. Consciousness is not self. All formations are impermanent. All phenomena are not self. But my mind does not launch out upon the stilling of all formations, the relinquishing of all acquisitions, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. Nor does it acquire confidence, settle down and resolve on it. Instead, agitation and clinging arise, and the mind turns back, thinking, 'But who is myself?' But such does not happen to one who sees the Dhamma. So who can teach me the Dhamma in such a way that I might see the Dhamma?" Then it occurred to the Venerable Channa, "This Venerable Ananda is dwelling at Kosambi in Kosita's park, and he has been praised by the teacher and is esteemed by his wise brothers in the holy life. The Venerable Ananda is capable of teaching me the Dhamma in such a way that I might see the Dhamma. Since I have so much trust in the Venerable Ananda, let me approach him." Then the Venerable Channa set his lodging in order, took his bowl and robe, and went to Gosita's park in Kosambi, where he approached the Venerable Ananda and exchanged greetings with him. When they had concluded their greetings and cordial talk, he sat down to one side and told the Venerable Ananda everything that had happened, adding, "Let the Venerable Ananda exhort me, let him instruct me, let him give me a Dhamma talk in such a way that I might see the Dhamma. Even by this much am I pleased with the Venerable Channa. Perhaps the Venerable Channa has opened himself up and broken through his barrenness. Lend your ear, friend Channa. You are capable of understanding the Dhamma." Then at once a lofty rapture and gladness arose in the Venerable Channa as he thought, "It seems that I am capable of understanding the Dhamma." The Venerable Ananda then said, "In the presence of the Blessed One, I have heard this, friend Channa. In his presence I have received the exhortation he spoke to the bhikkhu Kacchanagota." So, at this point, Venerable Ananda recites the Kacchanagota Sutta, which is also here in the Samyuttika Nikaya, which is one of the most, straightforward and just really straight-on kinds of suttas. So, here we go. At Sawati, then the Venerable Kacchanagota approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side, and said to him, Venerable Sir, it is said, right view, right view. In what way, Venerable Sir, is there right view? This world, Kachana, for the most part, depends on a duality, upon the notion of existence and the notion of non-existence. And the just for people, it's a little bit obscure there, the commentaries equate or gloss those as the beliefs of eternalism or the beliefs of annihilationism. That's the way they gloss the notions of existence and of non-existence. So the sense that, like in eternalism, the notion of existence, that everything is eternal, that there is a everlasting soul or self that continues on and does not end. And the notion of annihilationism being that nothing exists, that, say, you know, as an example, these khandhas cease at death, and that's it, annihilation. But for one who sees the origin of the world as it really is with correct wisdom, there is no notion of non-existence in regard to the world. And for one who sees the cessation of the world as it really is with correct wisdom, there is no notion of existence, eternalism, in regard to the world. So I think just to rephrase that a little bit, if it's at all confusing, just saying that basically one can't hold to a notion or a doctrine of annihilationism if one correctly sees the arising of phenomena, because you see the fact that phenomena continue to arise based on causes and conditions. And similarly, you can't hold to a notion of eternalism if you see with correct wisdom the cessation of phenomena, that all the phenomena that we usually refer to or regard as ourself are constantly in a process of ceasing as well, so arising and ceasing. This world, Kachana, is for the most part shackled by engagement, clinging, and adherence. But this one with right view does not become engaged and cling through that engagement and clinging, mental standpoint, adherence, underlying tendency. He does not take a stand about myself. He has no perplexity or doubt that what arises is only suffering arising. What ceases is only suffering ceasing. His knowledge about this is independent of others. It is in this way, Kachana, that there is right view. All exists. Kachana, this is one extreme. All does not exist. This is the second extreme. Without veering towards either of these extremes, the Tathagata teaches the Dhamma by the middle way, or by the middle. With ignorance as condition, volitional formations come to be. With volitional formations as condition, consciousness comes to be. And then he continues through the standard paticca-samuppada through suffering. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. But with the remainderless fading away and cessation of ignorance comes cessation of volitional formations. With the cessation of volitional formations, cessation of consciousness. And through to such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. So that's the teaching that Venerable Ananda gives. And the concluding paragraph in the Chana Sutta. So it is, friend Ananda, for those venerable ones who have such compassionate and benevolent brothers in the holy life to admonish and instruct them. And now that I have heard this Dhamma teaching of the Venerable Ananda, I have made the breakthrough to the Dhamma. So he enters the stream at that point. That's the end of the sutta. So I think that it's just a real heartening sutta too, because it kind of shows, Venerable Chana had a difficulty just kind of understanding the standard exposition of not self and impermanence in relation to the khandhas affected by clinging, and wasn't able to kind of rationally use those teachings to gain insight. It just wasn't clicking for him. But the very direct teaching of this one sutta did the trick for him. Basically, the very precise and straightforward notion that what arises is only suffering arising, what ceases is only suffering ceasing. And I think that's just also a really nice way that the Buddha has of marrying those two characteristics that are common to all conditioned phenomena, suffering and impermanence. And essentially, he's just basically saying that when it comes right down to it, that all experience in the mind arises and ceases, and that that essentially is suffering, that all five khandhas affected by clinging, that's really what it boils down to in terms of the practice, is seeing the arising and ceasing of that suffering in relation to anything that we take as me or mine, and that it can be that straightforward. So any thoughts, comments?
To me, one of the critical pieces of that sutta is Ananda giving Chana the confidence to believe in himself, to have faith and confidence. He got all the kind of the rational information already from years.
Didn't really
establish faith.
Yeah, that's I was really moved, when Ananda said that, saying, you are capable of understanding the Dhamma, and then this lofty rapture and gladness arose in him. Boy, it seems that I can understand the Dhamma. Wow.
Well, it sounds like it was for the first time Ananda was actually saying, okay, I don't know what's happening. Please,
yeah. That's true. And the importance of that uplift in the mind, the rapture and the gladness, to serve as a basis to soften the mind, to make it receptive.
Even just before that, he says, when Chanda asks for the teachings, he says, just even your coming here and humbling yourself and asking, I'm pleased with, even just that much, I'm pleased with your behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, right?
Yeah.
Some years ago, he said it was quite a long journey.
It wasn't just down the street. I can't remember exactly where Kusumbi is. I think it's up in the north of Patna somewhere. Mm-hmm. You been to India?
Isn't it? Isn't that close to the border of Nepal?
Yeah, I think it's up towards the. I'm just thinking, I have a vague recollection of the it going up towards north from Rajgir, and then going towards Kapilavati.
Digha. It's in the map is in the front of the Digha, if somebody wants to grab that real quick from the monk's office.
So I don't know if that when the notion of the world depends on this duality. That's this process of samsara, right?
Well, the world of the in the mind of most people, people who haven't at least entered the stream, is that in some way or another, experience is usually divided into, holding it with a view of eternalism or holding it with a view of annihilationism, and that's pretty much often how, most of us will base our actions and base our attitudes on. It's either, some even if it's, you know, a subtle assumption that this is going to last forever, or that I, you know, there is some self, you know, inherent self that has control, or, you know, the whole annihilationist thing of, you know, sort of like, you know, there's no continuity, there's no responsibility, there's no nothing.
So it's almost like it depends, would be like it supports ignorance to keep that process going, and supports that those views.
Well, ignorance, yeah, ignorance, I think, supports those views. You know, not knowing the truth of the Four Noble Truths is what it serves. You know, it's the basis for all of that.
Kosambi is actually directly west of Benares.
Directly west?
Directly west. Mm. And probably about, I'm just guessing, probably at least three-day walk. Probably 4 or 5 days. Mm. 4 or 5 days. Mm. So I'm just kind of looking at the distance. Gaia to Benares is a couple hundred kilometers, and it's about 2 days away.
So he was motivated. He was motivated.
Yeah, he was motivated.
Of course, if I knew the Venerable Nanda was just a 5-day walk away, I'd probably do it too.
Just in San Francisco.
For sure, no problem.
Is there any significance to the elders he initially approaches? They don't mention anything to him about dukkha. Mm-hmm.
Oh, there was a footnote about that. You know, the commentaries have their speculation as to why dukkha wasn't mentioned, which I will read out here, since you asked. Why didn't the bhikkhus mention the characteristic of suffering? Because they thought, this bhikkhu is argumentative. If we mention suffering, he will quarrel with us, saying, if form, etc. are suffering, the path and fruit, too, are suffering. So you monks have attained nothing but suffering. Thus they answered in a way that could not be faulted. So, I mean, that's, who knows? And then
China didn't have a great track record.
Right. And then Bhikkhu Bodhi says, see also Samsutta reference to in the Majjhima Nikaya, I don't know which one, where only impermanence and non-self are mentioned in the explicit context of debate. The commentary to that passage gives a similar explanation of the omission of suffering.
Yeah. I think we mentioned before something about the fact that the Buddha, or maybe I read this, I can't remember when it was mentioned, that the Buddha had some precognition about what, you know, he said this purposefully to Chana, you know, for Chana so that he knew Chana actually could be rehabilitated. Is the idea that he, you know, that he imposed this kind of act, and the idea that, at least I read that as, I think, a commentary or something.
Yeah.
He imposed it so that he knew that this would actually, was the last thing that would have an effect on China.
Yeah.
That's possible speculation.
Yeah, I can't remember reading that myself, I'm sure, but it wouldn't be surprising.
Not so much in terms of the teaching, but in terms of the actual punishment. Mm-hmm.
This will get his attention.
This doesn't wake him up, nothing. So.
I think it's also interesting that, you know, in that very dense teaching, he also says one should not take a stand on self. I find that very interesting, very helpful, because it's easy to sort of cling to an idea of not self rather than use it as an antidote to see the arising and passing away phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a polemical thing, it's a tool.
Mm-hmm.
So taking any stand on it.
And adhering to that.
Adhering to
it. Yeah, clinging to that.